good horse, I called you my shiny black bears, to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go riding,
you're listening to episode 596 of Unwelcome Guests, lifting the lid on the NSA. I'm Robin Upton. Our subtitle this week, Secret Rooms, Infiltration, and RAF Menworth Hill. And those are the three sections. It's a crowded show. We start with slightly over an hour from Mark Klein on how he broke the NSA's unwarranted wiretapping scandal. Now, thanks to Spill Edmonds and Peter B. Collins for this interview from the November 2009 episode of the Boiling Frogs podcast.
Our guest is Mark Klein, the former AT&T technician who broke the story, exposed the wiretapping that was underway here in San Francisco. And he's published a book called Wiring Up the Big Brother Machine and Fighting It. Mark Klein, welcome to the Boiling Frogs.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Well, it's a real pleasure to share this conversation with you and Sibel Edmonds, because I have the deepest respect for you and Sibel for your personal commitment to our Constitution and to the risks that you took to try to expose the wrongdoing and clear violations of our constitutional rights that you witnessed and observed. And so it's very special, I think, to have the two of you together on this podcast today.
Thanks. I'm glad to meet Sibel on the phone, at least, for the first time.
Well, and I imagine that our fictional minder, Benny, over at the NSA is listening very intently to this conversation. And I want to reference, for listeners who'd like to hear the full detailed story of Mark Klein's experiences, he sat for a 90-minute exclusive interview with me a few months back, and it's available on my website at peterbcollins.com, podcast number 19, again at peterbcollins.com. And, Mark, if you would, sketch briefly the experience you had working for AT&T and how you ended up in San Francisco and how you discovered what was going on in room 641A, in an AT&T building on Folsom Street in San Francisco.
Right. Well, I worked for AT&T as a communications technician most of those 22 and a half years. And I started in New York, and then I ended up transferring to San Francisco. And throughout that time, they were laying people off. I was always one step ahead of being laid off. In 2002, I was in this San Francisco office, and we got this strange email announcing that the NSA, it actually said the NSA was coming to talk to one of the management level technicians for a special job, which they wouldn't tell us about, of course. Anyway, as it happened, the guy came and I opened the door for him, and he spoke to one of the management level technicians. And it turned out, as weeks went by after that, that the scuttlebutt came around that they were building the secret room over at Folsom Street, also in San Francisco, where this guy was going to be working. And so I knew that right away that this was an NSA room being built inside a phone company building. The AT&T had three floors of this building. The rest of the building at the time was SBC, which is a local company.
Mm-hmm.
They've since merged back together. So I knew right away that this was wrong, because I remembered from back in the 70s, the NSA does not have a charter to do domestic spying.
That's right.
The FBI does that, and they need a warrant to do it. So I knew right away the NSA should not be there. As it happened, the following year in 2003, I was transferred into that office, and my primary assignment was to watch over the work in the internet room. And so, and doing that, And working in that office, I found that in the internet room there was a piece of equipment called a splitter, which was connected, as the engineering I had got hold of showed, the splitter was connected down to the secret room on the floor below. And through the splitter was running the main circuits for the data stream of the internet, everybody's internet traffic, email, web browsing, voice over internet, phone calls, pictures, video, whatever goes across the internet was going across these lines. And I had the documents which showed this. And the documents also showed that they were tapping into these lines and making copies of it, blind, total copies, no discrimination whatsoever, just total copies, were being sent to the secret room. And I also found from talking to people that, and one of the documents showed that there were other secret rooms. And I found out from firsthand talking to technicians that, well, some of them mentioned were in San Diego and Seattle and San Jose and Los Angeles. And documents, one of the documents mentioned Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
And later, when some experts looked at this, they figured there must have been 15 or 20 rooms, considering the scope of this layout.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, the gist of it was that they were basically copying the data running across the internet.
And Mark, without getting too technical,
yeah,
these fiber optic circuits could not be tapped or intercepted just by putting jumper cables on or diverting the stream through a box of some sort. This is an optical splitter, and I'm looking at the schematic that you published in your book. Are these splitters common? Are there other activities or applications for a splitter that wouldn't involve the diversion of traffic to, for example, the NSA?
Splitters can be used for common, ordinary purposes. The most common analogy people would be familiar with is a TV splitter in your house.
Mm-hmm.
If you're getting cable TV and you're getting all the channels in your living room and you want the channels to be available in your bedroom, well, they put in a little TV splitter that splits the signal on the cable. That handles electrical signals, though. The splitters I'm talking about handle fiber optic laser light signals, so which carries thousands of times more information. And generally, there can be innocent reasons for putting a splitter on a fiber cable, but generally they don't like to do it because it means a loss of signal level and it creates extra problems for them. But if you're, say, distributing the same signal to several locations, they might use a splitter to do that. But generally they don't want to do it.
Mm-hmm. Now, Mark, one of the very interesting things, and we'll go into more detail about this later, but you were in a novel position because you were aware of what was going on. You came into possession of some of the documents related to the technical changes that were made to implement this diversion. Yet you could not be silenced by the government because of a security clearance. The actual key technician who was doing most of the work in the secret room did have a security clearance. Is that correct?
That's right.
And so he was bound by those confidentiality and secrecy agreements. And that's what puts you in this unique position. So as you became aware of this and it bothered you and troubled you and you were able to collect some of these memos that were just laying around, what was going on in your head and what finally made you decide to try to share this information with, say, the media or some of our elected officials?
Well, looking at the engineering documents, I could see right away they were copying everything. I knew it was going into an NSA-controlled room, which us technicians could not enter, which, by the way, was a violation of our union agreement. And I knew this could not be legal. This must be illegal, because in order to do this kind of thing, first of all, they wouldn't get the NSA to do it. It would be the FBI. And you could not get a legal warrant that would say, give me all the emails in the country, which is basically what they were collecting. A warrant, as you know, has to be specific, as the Fourth Amendment calls for, have to say specifically the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized.
Mm-hmm.
That's to put a limit on government abuse. And looking at the documents, and I know this equipment, there was no selection at all going on the initial split. It was just a copy of everything.
Mm-hmm.
So what went into the government room was everything. So that's illegal right there. And they can claim all they want to doomsday that they later select out the legal stuff. But that's irrelevant. The point is they first get everything. And that can't be legal. And then, so I knew it was illegal right then. But this was a scary time, and I didn't say anything. I just took note of it. And when I retired in 2004, I took the engineering documents with me.
Mm-hmm.
In 2006, late end of 2005, New York Times revealed that there was this warrantless spying going on. And when I also should mention that when I first saw the secret room stuff in 2003, this is when there was this big uproar in Congress over the Total Information Awareness Program,
mm-hmm.
which was discovered, and that was also about government collecting all the electronic information they could about you.
And TIA was data mining. It had been started at the Pentagon under John Poindexter.
Right.
We were led to believe that it had been terminated, but they really just changed the name and moved it to a different office.
That's right. So I, when I heard about that, I figured this must be connected, because it was just too coincidental that they were installing this room at about the time that that whole TIA affair blew up. So, all right, so getting back to end of 2005, the New York Times revealed this stuff. So I knew that this is what they're talking about. This is completely illegal, warrantless wiretapping.
Mm-hmm.
And so I decided in 2006 to bring it forward, and I went to various media. There's a whole story, which is in my book, about how I went to the Los Angeles Times, and they were planning a big story. But then after they talked to the NSA director and the director of national intelligence, they killed the story.
I want to go into more detail on that in just a moment,
okay.
So save that for us, please.
All right. All right. Then there's a lot of other experiences like that, being with 60 Minutes as well. Then I brought the information to Civil Liberties Group, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, who, by coincidence, was actually preparing a lawsuit against AT&T when I walked in the door. It was just a coincidence. So they were very excited about my information, because this was very concrete, specific evidence. And eventually I became a witness for their lawsuit in April 2006. And then it took off, and then it got a lot of publicity at that point.
Mm-hmm.
The government stepped in to seize the documents at that point to see if there was any super classified information that they needed to guard in the documents. And ironically, they turned the documents back to us because they couldn't find anything classified in them. Which was another helpful thing to us, because we could prosecute the whole case without any classified information, because I don't have any security clearance. I didn't violate any security rules. The documents show documents that the documents are not classified, and they show that they split off this information on the internet to a secret room, and we don't need to know the classified information about what they do in their secret room to prove that they did something illegal. The illegality happened at the splitter. But the government wanted to kill this case, and they tried all kinds of means to stop it. And first they tried to invoke state secrets, and I'm sure Sibel Edmonds knows a lot about that one.
Yes, she does.
We happen to have an unusual judge who wouldn't buy that story. And the judge basically said, and he was a conservative judge, Judge Vaughn Walker, basically said, if there's any secrets, this court can guard the secrets in private sessions in court. So he denied the government's motion to dismiss on state secrets grounds. And that was a big blow to the government's case, because they had been hoping to get this case thrown out before anyone could even look at it.
Mm-hmm.
So that led to the next phase in the whole struggle, where the government decided they got to derail this case somehow, and they ended up eventually going to Congress to get Congress to grant immunity to the phone companies. That took 2 years, and they eventually got that. And that led to the dismissal of the case.
Mm-hmm. Sibel, go ahead.
I want to go back to the media, and I'm very familiar with the experience you had with the Los Angeles Times editor and the reporter. And one of the dilemma we are facing as the National Security Whistleblowers Coalition is where to send some of these whistleblowers or people who want to blow the whistle when it comes to the media, because we have been encouraging people who have seen and witnessed firsthand illegality, criminality, to basically disregard the their clearance and anything else in terms of the agreements they have signed with the government, and just come forward and put the information out to the public. But one of the problems we are having is it's very hard to know and to trust any media outlets or any particular reporters to send these whistleblowers to.
Right.
So what would you say to people who would come to you and say, okay, Mark, here it is, and I have this information, and it is, you know, certain illegal operations or a criminal case. Who do I go to? Where do I go? What would you tell those people?
Well, that's a hard one, because there's no guarantees. I would say, you know, well, first of all, if you're going to be a whistleblower, there's a good chance you'll lose your job. I was fortunate because I decided to retire first before I did any whistleblowing. So they couldn't get me on that score. Who to go to? Well, it's hard because you've got to convince them and at the same time convince them to take a chance.
Correct.
And they're largely a lot of chickens.
Well, but even that is a little too generous, Mark, because go into detail about your approach to the Los Angeles Times and how instead of honoring the confidentiality that they extended to you as a source and publishing the information, perhaps guarding your identity in the process, instead of doing that, which is the journalistic approach that one would have expected, they turned and gave your information to the top officials in the government and left you hanging in the breeze.
That's true. That put me in a real bad spot because I didn't have any other publicity. I didn't have any publicity to speak of at that point. And that's so when I figured that they were going to kill the story, I went to the New York Times. And that, too, was a risk, because they stalled. And I know the New York Times, their original expose in December 2005, they had sat on that story for a year.
Right.
After they had talked to the government about it. And the government, of course, counseled them not to run it. And they didn't run it, and they had the story before the 2004 elections, and they didn't run it. So there's no hard and fast rule that you can say, you know, do this and it'll work. But I do think it's true that you're in a safer situation once you can get the story to break out, because they're less likely to go after you, because then they're afraid of publicity. The government is afraid of this kind of publicity. And once it's out there, they don't want to go after you, generally speaking. But even then, I wouldn't say you're guaranteed, but I would say once it's out in the public, certainly, you're in a safer camp, and I think that's certainly why AT&T, who could have sued me for taking company documents, they demanded the documents back and I refused, and they did nothing. Why did they do nothing? Because they didn't want to go to court. They wanted to get out of court. They knew they were guilty, and if they sued me, then we could demand discovery in court and call witnesses, and it'll be a whole new level of publicity that they did not want. The same story applies tenfold to the government. They don't want this publicity.
Well, they need not to worry that much because their tentacles within the mainstream media is basically blacking out many stories like
right.
yours, like a lot of many members we have, National Security Whistleblowers Coalition. I think one of the biggest risks ends up being, let's say even if a person has decided, okay, this is I'm going to do it, and yes, the publicity, in a way, will provide me a layer of with a layer of protection, but then they would go and they would share witnesses, documents, etc., with a reporter, and not only that, this story doesn't get out after that, won't get out, they actually get into trouble because the reporters or the reporters' editors have actually notified the agency in question.
Yeah.
That is the scariest scenario, and we have had firsthand experiences with that. I have had firsthand experience, and one of these experiences I have talked about without naming names, but I'm going to go ahead and blow the whistle here and set example, as you did with Los Angeles Times. It was Vanity Fair put a piece out there on Dennis Hastert in 2005,
right.
And they had several sources, and they listed those sources, and there was this blackout by every single media outlet. And I'm talking about on the left, on the right, by everyone. This incredible silence, eerie
right.
silence. Okay. A few months later, the election is coming up, okay, in November, and I just could not stand it. I mean, here is Dennis Hastert running for office again, and his constituents are going to go and vote without knowing who this guy is. I mean, you're looking at this huge amount of responsibility you feel, you know, notching at you. So I went and I convinced three FBI agents, okay? Two of them had never blown the whistle, had never come out publicly to... For the importance of it, to go on the record for the first time, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Go on the record with documents, with
yeah.
everything, detailed, and disclose this thing on Hastert, because 2 months later, 2 months after that, they were, you know, going to have this. They were going to go to the booths and vote. So I asked around, and here I'm supposed to be the knowledgeable one. One of the people that I trust a lot told me, well, the best place to go is McClatchy, okay?
Right.
All right, good. And who in McClatchy? Well, because it involves D.C. politics, here is a contact information talk with the bureau chief for Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
The gentleman's name is Jim Asher, right?
Mm-hmm.
It took me a lot to convince these agents, okay, to come forward. And they said, okay, they will do it once on the record. They will just do it once, okay? And actually, one of them said, Sabelle, I will tell you this. They will not run it. They will not publish this because it touches, you know, not only Hastert, but many other people.
Right.
I set up the meeting, and I have email records of all this, okay? Jim Asher and these agents, right, in a coffee house in a particular location. The hours works out. We meet there, and for the first time, these guys... They think, okay? Not only that, they gave him information, they share certain documents, they actually put forward another witness that I didn't even know about who had first-hand information on this.
Yeah.
After that meeting, nothing happened. A day, 2 days, 5 days, 10 days, my phone calls, their phone calls, nothing, okay? Then I started doing some real research and I started talking to people. And a person that you're very familiar with, Mark, and you have, you know this person, I'm not going to name him, who knows McClatchy very well. He said, well, who did you guys talk with McClatchy? I said, well, this person. Said, oh, my God. His nickname is Darth Vader. He was stationed and was given that position for one purpose only, because McClatchy took over Night Ridders.
That's right.
And they put that guy there to make sure that Jonathan Landay and another reporter won't get out of control.
Right.
And this guy is a government tentacle, and he's one of the dirtiest guys you would come across. And here, I just named him, and I'm doing it because I have email records, and I have three FBI agents who would come forward and vouch. And guess what? November came, people went there, and they voted, and Hastert got reelected. Okay?
Yeah.
These are the kind of situations that and then the agents basically blamed me. They said, we trusted you. Okay? Well, two of these agents were already retired, but what if they were still working? Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So this is the sorry state of our media, and McCletchie is not even considered like one of the big mainstream big bad guys. McCletchie has the reputation of, oh, yeah, they are liberal and they are good, but not everyone in McCletchie is, and this is what you get. So it's very difficult to forward whistleblowers to trustworthy reporters or publications because where are they?
Being a whistleblower, particularly if you're coming out of the government in a national security environment, is very risky, and there's not a lot of places to go to. And I think it's generally true. The government has 1,000 different ways to keep their fingers on all the different institutions of society, including the media. By getting back to the Los Angeles Times story, one of the things that came out there was when they were considering the story that they were writing and they were showing it to the government officials, they were also talking to Senator Feinstein's office about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so people like her... And she was working against me. She was trying to get the lawsuit killed, which she eventually did.
Well, and let me just jump in here, Mark, and read a couple of quick quotes from your book.
Sure,
because Steve Cash was Feinstein's top intelligence consultant or advisor. And you have a note here from February 3rd of 2006.
Right.
Steve Cash called, is very interested in the documents. Wanted to verify that they are indeed tapping into fiber and copper circuits. Told him I can only verify fiber. He goes on, and you say, he wanted to know if I know they were indeed doing unlawful interception. I said, I don't have first-hand evidence of that. I don't have a security clearance, but I know only people with NSA clearance could go in that room. And he said he would be in touch with me on Monday. And you write, but I never heard from him Monday or ever again.
Right.
And I was unable to get through to him or the senator. And later, my well-connected attorneys ran into the same brick wall.
Right.
So here we have this collusion between Feinstein, who I don't have respect for when it comes to intelligence, and she's now chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee. She's been an apologist for the NSA, has worked to try to legalize the law-breaking that they did and the phone companies collaborated on. And so we see this ugly specter that you, a confidential source, have been exposed by both your United States senator and the Los Angeles Times to John Negroponte, who was the National Intelligence Director at that time. And surprise, surprise, the LA Times decided they wouldn't publish that story. And then you saw this, you certainly were afraid of what might happen to you as a result, and you were kind of feverishly trying to get some publicity because you felt that was the best way to protect yourself. So then you're kind of brokering this back and forth between the LA Times and the New York Times. And tell us what happened with these star reporters, Eric Lichtblau and James Risen, who covered the NSA for the New York Times.
Well, they seem to be very interested, and I believe they were, in covering this. And there was a flurry of excited phone calls, and then there was a strange silence for a few weeks. And I didn't hear from them. And I figured they were having some problem with their editors, who were reluctant. And so I didn't get callbacks from them until we suddenly, when the government intervened and seized the documents when we were filing the lawsuit, my declaration for the lawsuit and the documents that went with it, the government came in and seized them to look at them before they gave them back. When the government did that, inadvertently for the government, attracted a lot of media attention, because that seemed to confirm for the media that there's more here than just Mark Klein's story. If the government wants to see these documents, so we suddenly got a bunch of publicity, and then the New York Times called me back, and then they did a little story, and then they did an editorial and a bigger story. So that was my breakthrough. I did get finally a breakthrough with the New York Times in that sense, although it was reticent and slow in coming.
And on page 18 or something.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. And then they never called me back after that. You'd think after they ran the story where they talked, they showed the documents to four experts, and all four of them concluded this is some kind of secret, probably illegal, large government surveillance operation. And so they ran that. And then they never called me back. They asked me more questions. Very strange, right? So I get the feeling at the Times they were conflicted. Their editors were conflicted and being, you know, thrown about by this. And so they did, at least they gave me that initial little breakthrough, which helped. But I kept running into that kind of stuff, which indicated to me not only reticence on the part of the editors, but pressure from the government.
Mark, I have a question on New York Times, because
yeah.
I believe I'm correct that it was New York Times who actually hired that same editor from the L.A. Times, and now he is the
right.
D.C. bureau chief for New York Times. Mm. Do you think that's a coincidence?
Yeah, that's pretty funny. Well, that came later. Let's see, what was it? The ABC Nightline, when they broadcast my story in early 2007, they followed up on my story about the L.A. Times, and they investigated, and they found out it was true, and they found out that the guy who nixed my story was Dean Baquet, B-A-Q-U-E-T, I think it is, or Q-E-T, I forget, who was later hired to be the Washington bureau chief of the New York Times. So it's a small club, you know. The New York Times came out somewhat better because they did at least print something. But they all move in that same Washington circle and are under the same government pressures, you know. So I'm sure that explains the New York Times lead-footed approach to this thing. They were very reluctant, and then they finally did something, but it was like the absolute minimum. But it was something, at least. It helped me.
Now let me ask you, Mark and Sibel, to compare notes, because you two are members of a club that I'm not.
Yeah.
I have never been interviewed by 60 Minutes. And, Mark, you told me previously that they recorded an interview with you and demanded an exclusive, and that, in essence, this silenced you for, what, 6 to 9 months as you waited for CBS to broadcast that piece?
Yeah, this is another one of those suspicious events. In the fall, in the summer of 2006, we had gotten a bunch of publicity, and we were approached by several national TV groups to be the first out the gate with the exclusive TV interview with me. And 60 Minutes was right up there fighting for it, so we gave it to them. And they flew me to New York in September 2006. I was interviewed by Steve Croft, and then we waited. And we waited, and we waited. And every month they had another reason why it's not now, it's going to be next week, or we have to run this now. And they always had an excuse for postponing it. Oh, after four months, we gave up, and we went to ABC Nightline, who did something and aired it, and also PBS Frontline also at the same time. And CBS 60 Minutes never aired that show. And I suspect it was killed for political reasons, but they couldn't tell us that, so they just kept putting us off. They never came up with any good reason.
And Sibel, what was your experience with 60 Minutes?
My experience was with Ed Bradley, and he was nice, actually, and he asked some really good questions that I wanted him to ask, and that had to do with the core issues I blew the whistle on. And even though they aired it in a timely manner, and actually they re-aired it, they edited a lot of good main points of the interviews, which had to do with the espionage operations within Pentagon and the State Department. for example, at the time, Major Douglas Dickerson and the fact that he was working for Douglas Fight and Richard Pearl, all that was out, and instead they chose to focus on the whistleblower angle, the poor little whistleblower, and the war on terror, and the fact that, you know, FBI needs better, you know, more money, and they don't have enough of... They just made it a translator's issue in the FBI rather than what the case was about, which mm-hmm. was the serious espionage operations that involved many well-known U.S. persons,
yeah.
you know, some of them within the State Department. So it was basically edited and polished to reflect that. And I got stuck with that image, and I got stuck with that basically a message for the case. It's like, oh, you're the person who blew the whistle on incompetence in FBI. And I'm like, no, that's not what I blew the whistle on. This is not what I, and this is not why they invoked the state secrets privilege, the government, not because they were trying to cover up the incompetence in the FBI's translations department. It had to do with this and this and this. But that did a lot of damage, because then later people can come and say, well, this story expanded, and this is not what you said in, you know, during CBS 60 Minutes. It had to do with incompetence. And I'm like, no. I said that tape was 1.5 to 2 hours, okay? What they aired, the program, was 15 minutes. Out of that 15 minutes was maybe 4 minutes directly by me. There were senators who talked, et cetera, et cetera. They didn't make me look bad, but they made the case about something that this case was not about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Generally, I'm thinking, I have to say I'm a student of history also, and it's hard to do whistleblowing in a reactionary period when there's not much social struggle going on. Generally, the government has exaggerated power and is able to intimidate people into silence, including the media. And so that makes whistleblowing more difficult. I'm comparing, like, the present period with, say, the height of the Vietnam War, when you had hundreds of thousands of people marching in the street against the government, and that encouraged people like Daniel Ellsberg to bring out the Pentagon Papers and gave some backbone to a newspaper like the New York Times to actually publish it.
Absolutely.
So,
that's an excellent point.
So
well,
point
and it's also interesting, excuse me, both of you, Dan Ellsberg is featured in a new documentary called The Most Dangerous Man in America. Sibel and I have both seen it, and she has talked to Dan Ellsberg since that was released. And the two factors that we've touched on that were present for Ellsberg that were not present for either of you were that he did get help from members of both political parties. Republican Pete McCloskey and Democrat Mike Gravel went to great lengths to support Ellsberg in releasing the Pentagon Papers. And then we had courageous media outlets, the Washington Post and the New York Times, and they were supported by lesser newspapers around the country right. when the New York Times defied the government's effort to prevent publication. And those are factors that are seriously deficient in the current context.
Right. Extending that thought, back then what you had in the height of the Vietnam War was a split in the ruling parties, a split over the war. And that creates splits in the media and people willing to come forward and make statements against the government that they wouldn't otherwise have the guts to make. And the significant factor in today's situation is there are not such splits, that the two parties stand united on the issue of our time, and that is the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Neither party is arguing for withdrawal. Both parties defend why they might argue with each other over trivia like the public option and the health care plan. They are united on the fundamentals. Both parties want to continue this war. Both parties believe in the national security state surveillance and all the accoutrements of the apparatus that goes with that, you know, government spying. There's no fundamental disagreements there.
Yeah.
And so it's hard to crack a bureaucracy like that when there's, you know, no great social struggle in the streets, frankly.
Mm-hmm. That's a very powerful point. Now, Mark, we talked earlier about the senior senator from California, Dianne Feinstein, and the way that she not only didn't support you, but actively undermined your efforts. In your book, you said that Barbara Boxer, the other senator from California, was interested and did, through a staffer, hear you out. And I wanted to ask, because I took a signed copy of your book, Wiring Up the Big Brother Machine and Fighting It, to Senator Boxer in August of 2009, this year, and I gave it to her with a greeting from you, that she was favorably mentioned in the book, and at the time I said, I want my Fourth Amendment rights back. And she kind of smiled in an uncomfortable way and looked at me and said, well, what do you mean? And I said, well, the wiretapping continues, and we need to remove the immunity from the phone companies, and we need to come up with a clear legal structure for the assertion of state secrets. And she said, yeah, and moved on. So I wanted to know if there was any further contact between Senator Boxer's office and you after I delivered your book.
No. All Boxer did, and I mentioned in the book, is she invited me to a meeting of some of her supporters at an apartment in Washington where I got to give a little few minutes presentation on what I thought was going on with the surveillance. She didn't help me beyond that, and frankly, I don't think she could because she doesn't sit on the appropriate committees which would give her the power to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
I think she's on, like, what, the environment?
Environment committee. And yeah. Maybe so, judiciary.
Right. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I don't think she'd want to buck the leadership over this issue anyhow. The one who did buck the leadership was Senator Dodd, but he got overridden. He stuck his neck out on it for his own personal background reasons. But I think the point is that the Congress as a whole joined together, united, to cover up the NSA issue. That's basically what the Democrats did. They joined with the Republicans to cover up this issue and kill the lawsuit. And in that, they're united, just as they're united over the war, because the two issues are connected. The surveillance issue is a derivative of the war issue, and it's all tied together. And so long as the wars go on, this other stuff will go on. And there's no challenge to the war from the two parties, and that's the main problem we face in this country.
No, the real war that will never end is the perpetual war. It's the war on terror. See, even if we were to get out of Iraq and we were to get out of Afghanistan, we are still in this war on terror, involved in this war on terror, which has basically gotten us into the Patriot Act and everything else that we are dealing with domestically. And that war, we can't withdraw from anywhere to get out of that
war. Well,
that
was the point of it.
That's the perpetual war, isn't it?
That was the point of it, to create a permanent, unstoppable war atmosphere so they can get whatever they want. Nevertheless, it would help a lot if they actually withdrew troops from Iraq and Afghanistan. There's absolutely no rationale left for either of those wars. Everybody knows the Iraq war was based on a complete lie. And Afghanistan, you know what? It was supposed to get Osama bin Laden, and he's long gone. But the war goes on. It has a life of its own. And Obama continues it with this almost the same words that Bush uses. It's like a bunch of zombies continuing on the same path.
Well, many people are getting rich from these wars.
Yeah.
I just was looking at this report issued by Project Censored, and they listed the top 10 senators and congressmen and congresswomen who have invested the most in the military-industrial complex. And I believe number two is Senator Kerry, who has $38 million invested in of his investment portfolio in military-industrial complex. And number four, I believe, is Jane Harman, who has invested about $8-something million. Mm-hmm. So there are people and there are institutions that are really, really getting rich off the war.
Yeah.
And as far as the Congress goes, and this is why we stopped our congressional activities altogether in 2007, some people may consider it giving up or giving up too easily, but what we realized was only thing that moves these people is the lobbyists and the money poured into their pockets. When you look at the AT&T and the report issued by the Sunlight Foundation, they were looking at Senator McCain, who had directly benefited by $390,000 just from the telecom industry. And these are the people who have been and who had pushed the immunity for the telecom. And when you look at how much money is, you know, they're getting from the telecom industry and the related lobby, it becomes pretty simple and obvious. So with the whistleblowers and with these cases, it's like, okay, that's the price, let's say, for McCain, $390,000. If he can give McCain $400,000, and if he can give Feinstein and Harmon each maybe $150,000, $200,000, you will see them maybe moving and doing something. Or am I right or am I wrong?
Well, let me just add to it, Sibel, that 3 weeks after the Democratic-controlled House and Senate passed the immunity for the telecoms in the summer of 2008. Let me just amend that. They didn't control the Senate at that time, but they did control the House. 3 weeks after that, the Democrats convened in Denver, and I was there for the nominating convention. And on the very first night, there was a huge and very expensive party thrown for delegates and elected officials only. The media was not permitted to attend or even observe the proceedings. And the host was AT&T, and the credential lanyards that everybody wore at the DNC in the summer of 2008 had the AT&T logo all over them. So was that a coincidence?
Well, certainly there's a lot of lobbyist money that helped pass the immunity, but there's also a general feeling among the Congress that they've got to protect the intelligence agencies against any political embarrassment or illegalities, the same, because they don't want to delve into that. It would mean a huge split and a fight. It's why Obama does not want to go after the people at the top who committed torture. Everybody knows now that torture's been committed by and sanctioned by the highest levels of government, by Bush, by Cheney, Condoleezza Rice, and Donald Rumsfeld, and they get off. They're gone. Nobody's going after them. And so that creates a whole atmosphere among Congress. They're protecting all their buddies. You know, they all cover for each other, right? And so if they're impervious to any attempt to get at the root of this problem, frankly, I don't want to get into it sounding too hopeless, but I don't see a solution to this through the two parties. They're too vested in the current institutions and the keeping things going as they are.
Well, and there's no way for us to revise the campaign finance system without their approval.
Yeah, I mean, they have control of the strings. They have control. You know, 50, 60 years ago, you'd say, well, we can fix this. We'll go to Congress, we'll get a hearing, and they'll pass a law to fix it. Well, now we know Congress is in the same boat with all the culprits here, right?
So, yeah.
So who do you go to? What's left?
So what happened to the government of the people, for the people, by the people, then, Mark?
Well, that's the problem that we face. I think we need some a new political party based on working people and unions. I'm a unionist, to revive, you know, as a counterweight to this government apparatus, which seems to have its fingers in everything.
Establishment, and I have a phrase for it, two sides of the same coin with the two-party system.
Yeah. It's shocking. Everybody's shocked now. I wasn't one of the people who supported Obama. I didn't have either. I'm not a Democrat or a Republican. But the ones who did are sorely disappointed now, you can see, because on every issue, he's taken up not just wiretapping surveillance, but education, health care. He's taken the right-wing position, you know. Education, he's for charter schools. Health care, he's for giving insurance companies what they want. You know, you can go down the line.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he's been at least consistent with his record, because before he was elected, that's exactly where he stood on these issues, didn't he?
Yeah, well, that's the funny thing. I think he's fooled people. I think if you want to figure him out on a personal level, he seems to be really a conservative, dressed up as a liberal for elections purposes. But he really thinks like a conservative.
Or he's told to act as conservative. It comes down to their establishment people. Are they the decision makers, or do we have what we refer to in other countries, third world countries, as the deep state? And you're looking at the vested interest, and you're looking at right. Is he the man who makes a decision? Is he really?
Well, the bottom line is we get the same result, so there's something wrong here. After a certain point, it doesn't matter how he justifies it in his own mind. He produces the same, more or less the same stuff that Bush did. He just doesn't use the same words.
Yeah.
He gives cleverer and more intelligent speeches.
But let's not get the people off the hook here, because how about the people and their responsibility? Do we really deserve this? Because I think maybe we do, because a lot of it happens to depend on us. And you look at this latest case with the Electronic Frontier Foundation and this bogus subpoena case. In this case, the Department of Justice served their national security letters to this alternative media site, indiemedia.us, and the person who happened to be in charge did not go along with the gag order. She ran to the EFF and presented them with this, and she said, okay, this is what I got, and now a subpoena is coming from the court. And EFF took the case, challenged it, and they won.
Yeah.
The judge declared it bogus. The Department of Justice backed down, all because this one person, this woman, decided not to comply with unconstitutional, un-American gag provision and an order, national security letters. But she is one of the four who have publicly, you know, people who have received these letters, but have come out publicly, challenged the gag orders, and one, three librarians and this lady. So what happens to thousands of people who are receiving these letters? They're complying quietly, they're turning over documents, and they are sitting and complying with gag orders. How American is that?
Well, they're scared, obviously.
Well, they are, and if they are, and if they don't believe that their Constitution is there to protect them, if they believe this is how things are, and if they accept it, whether it's fear, whether it's intimidation, then do we say, well, then they deserve it? Because that's the story of every nation that falls into dictatorship or into a police state. It's the people complying with it, whether it's because they are driven by economic factors or from fear factors, the terrorist factors. But then do we say, well, maybe we deserve it as a nation? Otherwise, we'll be revolting right now. We'll have a revolution.
Well, I can. There's an understandable fear. I wouldn't want to put too much blame on people for not wanting to risk their job or what have you. It needs to be independent organization outside of the government. People feel more confident to come forward and challenge things if they feel an organization is behind them. And I think that's what's needed: independent organizations to protest these things. That's why it's important to have groups like the EFF. And I think that's why it's important to have unions, too. I was glad to have, you know, you're in a workplace, when the boss does stuff to challenge your rights in the workplace, like listening in on your phone conversations, which happens at AT&T and other places, you had a union to go to. And if you don't have a union, you feel much more isolated, and it's much more scary to try to challenge that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Mark, I have a few questions sent to me by Richard Scott Ishmael, a.k.a. Ishmael, who writes for our website. He's a partner contributor, and I'm just going to go through some of these questions, if it's okay with you.
Sure.
See if there are any of these questions you can answer. One question he has is, were any dedicated domestic circuits routed through to the NSA rooms, to his knowledge, to your knowledge?
What I expose in the book is that there were very specific circuits. If fiber optic circuits that were routed into the NSA room. I named some of them. Some of them were circuits that go to other companies. They connect AT&T to other companies, what they called peering links. And that's what shows that they were tapping into the whole Internet.
Okay. And another question has to do with these designated terminal office locations and whether you have any knowledge of similar rooms constructed in transship offices like Oakland, Newhall, or others.
Oakland, Newhall.
What he wrote here is that the offices that you listed, some 20 different offices
yeah.
where you either believe or know that there
yeah.
were splitters, that he describes them all as terminal office locations, and I don't really know the difference between a terminal office and a transship office.
I'm not sure what he's getting at, so I can't answer it. I don't know the other locations of the offices except the ones that I named in my book, the locations where there are secret rooms. And I only had my hand on a small piece of this obviously huge surveillance apparatus, so I can't claim to be an expert on where they've tapped into things, except to show that they obviously were trying to collect a lot of domestic traffic. That's clear from the documents. And I saw his posting on your website, and I made that point in my book that if they wanted to just collect international traffic, they could have had just a much smaller, minimal installation near cable stations. But instead, they put it in major cities where they would collect a lot of domestic traffic automatically, which leads me to conclude that this surveillance was designed for domestic surveillance.
And it might surprise people to know that the international traffic that comes in on the cables, the undersea cables, terminate in two specific locations, one in New Jersey and one near San Luis Obispo, California. So those are easy terminal points for them to access if their goal was simply to intercept international traffic.
That's right. That's a major point that I made in my book and James Bamford made in his book. That this gives a lie to the whole Bush line and now the Obama line that they're just looking at international communication. No, they're collecting domestic traffic automatically.
And one last question from Ishmael. What
yeah.
is your take on the NSA's parallel National Traffic Control Center?
And that's parallel to the phone companies, I think he's referring to.
I think Bamford would be better to answer that. They seem to be building centers near major data collection points, like the one in Texas is near some Microsoft center. They do the same when they collect international stuff. They set up collection points near satellite stations
mm-hmm.
so that they can collect just by the overflow. When a satellite beams down to a ground station, they can collect the same information coming from the satellite. That's how they spy on satellite communications. That's easier than trying to pry open fiber optic cable.
And one little factoid that may be helpful to some of our listeners is that one of the reasons why the NSA needed to use these fiber intercepts, these splitters and diversions of the fiber optic traffic, is that over the last 20 years, a lot of communications that used to be beamed from here to other parts of the world by satellite has gone to cables. And it's because of the speed of fiber optics and the huge capacity. And this created a problem for the NSA, which was set up under the old system to intercept these satellite-delivered communications.
Right. But even so, like I say, they didn't have to tap into the cables in various cities if they only wanted international traffic. I think that was just a story they put out
because
mm-hmm. they want more than just international traffic. They wanted the domestic traffic, is my opinion. That's the revelation of the documents, I believe.